It is nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT, broadcasting on 100.1 FM. It is your public radio station here in beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 61 degrees under mostly cloudy skies. Out at the airport, they have southerly winds at 12 miles per hour and 10 miles of visibility. The Weather Service is calling for a 40% chance of rain today, a 20% chance of rain tonight, south winds to about 10 miles per hour through the period. Overnight low tonight of about 51. Coming up on the Midday Report, passengers had to be treated for smoke inhalation after a fire broke out on an Alaska Marine Highway System ferry. Small Business Administration Administrator Isabel Guzman is visiting Alaska. And the Dillingham School District wants to start growing its own greens. They're going to invest in hydroponics. Those stories and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Former President Donald Trump is expected to turn himself in to authorities in Georgia tonight. Raoul Valley with member station WABE reports Trump will be booked on 13 felony charges in connection with his alleged efforts to overturn the state's 2020 election results.
The former president is expected to go through the standard arrest procedure, including being fingerprinted and photographed. The Fulton County Sheriff's Office has been regularly releasing booking photos of some of the other defendants that have already turned themselves in, including attorneys Rudy Giuliani and John Eastman. Trump also has to post a $200,000 bond, which requires him to not intimidate other defendants or witnesses, including on social media. All defendants have until noon Friday to turn themselves in. For NPR News, I'm Raoul Bally in Atlanta.
Trump's expected surrender comes a day after Republican presidential contenders held the first debate of the 2024 campaign. NPR's Domenico Montanaro says last night's debate in Milwaukee offered a snapshot of what the field could look like without Trump, who's leading most polls by double digits.
Trump didn't show up to the debate, and that meant he wasn't there to defend himself from the inevitable attacks. But for most of the first hour, Trump wasn't even mentioned. The candidates instead debated the economy, crime, abortion, and climate change. Former tech CEO Vivek Ramaswamy became the unexpected focus. He exuded confidence but seemed to irritate the other candidates, including former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley. She had a strong debate performance, but the candidate polling second, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, seemed to fade into the background. That could create an opening in the anyone other than Trump lane in the primary.
NPR's Domenico Montanaro reporting. Russian President Vladimir Putin is expressing his condolences for the families of the victims killed in a plane crash near Moscow yesterday. But NPR's Charles Maines reports Putin stopped short of confirming that Wagner chief Yevgeny Prigozhin was killed in the crash.
Looking somber as he delivered televised remarks, President Putin said initial reports suggested members of the Wagner mercenary group were aboard the plane when it crashed. The Kremlin leader then praised Wagner's contributions to the war effort in Ukraine, saying they wouldn't be forgotten. Putin also spoke about his decades-long relationship with Wagner chief Yevgeny Prigozhin, referring to him in the past tense and calling him a talented person who'd made serious mistakes, an apparent reference to a rebellion launched by Prigozhin against the Russian military earlier this summer. Putin did not expressly confirm Prigozhin's death, but vowed an investigation into the crash would be carried out in full. Charles Baines, NPR News, Moscow.
On Wall Street, the Dow was down 373 points. This is NPR.
NPR News is brought to you in part by Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. For an appointment or more information, 481-2400.
For KMXT, I'm Terry Haynes. A fire broke out early Wednesday morning aboard an Alaska Marine Highway System ferry traveling through the Wrangell Narrows. As KSTK's Sage Smiley reports, the fire sent almost a dozen passengers and crew to Wrangell's hospital to be treated for smoke inhalation.
Looking at the ferry Columbia from the shore in Wrangell at about 11:45 in the morning on Wednesday, there didn't appear to be anything amiss. That is, except that the 418-foot ferry wasn't supposed to be in Wrangell. The Columbia should have left for Ketchikan at 6:15 that morning, but an overnight fire in its bar delayed the ship as 11 people were taken off the ferry to be medically evaluated. Stephen Harrison is a crew member on the Columbia. He was part of the fire response team.
In the bar last night at 3:15 in the morning, there was a general alarm went off, and they said that it was not a drill, which is pretty obvious. At 3:15, we wouldn't have a drill in the middle of the Wrangell Narrows. So all the people on Fire Team 1, we jumped up and ran for our fire suits. They told us to get dressed, and we all donned our fire suits, put on our oxygen tanks, and went on oxygen because the ship was filling up with smoke.
By the time Harrison got to the fire, he says it had already mostly been extinguished by another crew member.
But there was still smoldering, so we took water in and sprayed down the bar. So there's a lot of dirt and debris and ashes in the bar mixed with the ABC fire extinguisher stuff. So it kind of made a little bit of a mess, and it's going to take us a while to clean up.
Harrison says his 6-person fire team was using supplemental oxygen, which helped them avoid the effects of smoke inhalation. But other crew and passengers felt the effects. Shannon McCarthy is a spokesperson for Alaska's Department of Transportation, which oversees the ferry system.
The crew reacted pretty quickly, but out of an abundance of caution, they wanted to make sure that anyone that was nearby got seen for smoke inhalation.
Emergency medical services in Wrangell transported 11 people to the local hospital for treatment. All the patients had been treated and released from the Wrangell Medical Center by early afternoon, according to a hospital spokesperson, and McCarthy says all 11 reboarded the ship and continued south. Harrison says he thinks the fire didn't cause any serious damage to the ship.
We lost 10 cases of Alaska white beer. Honestly, that's the extent of the damage.
It's not totally clear how the fire started. Harrison says the working theory is that an ice machine in the bar area started the fire.
We're assuming some sort of electrical malfunction, or maybe it was just too close to the cardboard cases of beer. We don't know.
The Columbia came back into regular service on the Alaska Marine Highway in mid-February after being docked for 3 years as a cost-saving measure. The 49-year-old vessel is the largest of the Marine Highway's 4 mainline ferries, serving larger communities with cabins and berths for longer journeys. The Columbia was briefly tied up for repairs earlier this summer after crew noticed issues with one of its thrusters and leaking pipes in the ship's fire suppression system. It's not the only ferry that's experienced mechanical issues recently. The Hubbard was waylaid by generator issues earlier this month. The Alaska Marine Highway is running thin, with 5 of its 9 ferries in service as of August 23rd. The Kennecott, Taslina, and Matanuska are in layup in the boatyard in Ketchikan, and the Lituya is in overhaul until August 24th. Harrison says he's proud of the response of the Columbia crew and fire team.
It proved to us that we actually could respond and do what we needed to do in the amount of time that we needed to do it, and it all went out really well. It was a great drill. I mean, it was a live fire drill, basically.
The Columbia left Wrangell heading south just after noon Wednesday after passengers and crew returned from receiving treatment. DOT doesn't expect the fire to cause any delay to the ship's schedule. It's expected to arrive in Bellingham on Friday morning. In Wrangell, I'm Sage Smiley.
Administrator Isabella Guzman of the U.S. Small Business Administration visited Nome on Wednesday to tour the future port expansion project site. Guzman represents 33 million small businesses across the nation, hundreds of which are in Nome. Over her 3-day trip, Guzman visited Ketchikan, Anchorage, and Nome over the course of 3 days to meet with small business owners. KNOM's Ava White has more about her time in Nome.
The Arctic Deep Draft Port in Nome, which is anticipated to encourage economic viability, will ensure that supplies, food, and fuel reach residents of rural Alaskan communities in a cost-effective manner. The Arctic's first deepwater port will attract and ensure economic development in the region, says Guzman.
On an immediate basis, the port means job creation, contracts for our small businesses and 8A participants.
The 8A program is a 9-year-long business development program owned and controlled by socially or economically disadvantaged individuals. The federal government aims to award 5% of total federal contracting dollars to 8A programs each year. A roundtable discussion with Native Corporation leaders took place on Wednesday. Bering Straits Native Corporation, Kowarik, Sitnasauk Native Corporation, Nome Eskimo Community, and Bering Straits Regional Housing Authority all attended. Administrator Guzman exemplified the efforts BSNC is taking towards building the city's infrastructure.
We visited the Sound Quarry, which is one of the companies of BSNC, that they're hopefully going to be a part of, you know, building this infrastructure. They're already working on an airport project, and hopefully they'll work on the port as well as they, as they source locally when they're building this, the Port of Nome. And that's what the SBA is trying to ensure, that small businesses have an opportunity to plug into these contract opportunities.
Administrator Guzman visited the small businesses of Bering Tea and Coffee, Natuk Gear, and the local grocery stores. Noting the high cost of prices overall, Administrator Guzman stressed the importance of the port with resource distribution.
You know, there's more opportunity to distribute resources, potentially attract some more tourism as well to the region with better connectivity. And I think, you know, infrastructure connects communities. It allows, you know, it gets your goods around, but it also allows you to get more customers.
In the Norton Sound region, Administrator Guzman says that while it varies from business to business, a lack of workforce remains a struggle for many small businesses beyond Alaska.
You know, workforce continues to be a challenge around the country, but particular challenges here in Alaska. Some inflationary pressures. We've seen cooling of inflation. We've seen this incredible economic recovery with great job creation sustaining, businesses still have to, you know, figure out how to strengthen their bottom line, be more efficient, grow their revenues.
The SBA opened an Alaska Women's Business Center in Anchorage to offer virtual and in-person support to women-owned businesses. Administrator Guzman says the Veterans Business Outreach Center and Alaska Women's Business Center connect small businesses and aspiring entrepreneurs to SBA resources.
It's wonderful to be able to open up all these opportunities for infrastructure building, get small businesses and our 8A entities engaged in these contracts.
The SBA is the only go-to resource and voice for small businesses backed by the federal government. Over 20,000 small business applications have been submitted in the state alone since President Biden launched the Investing in America program. Reporting from Nome, I'm Ava White.
Months after a new wave of flooding began in the Kenai area neighborhood, residents gathered to discuss mutual experiences and solutions. As KDLL's Riley Board reports, officials say they're doing all they can and continue to discourage residents from taking matters into their own hands in ways that can negatively impact their neighbors.
Residents of a Northwest Kalifornsky Beach neighborhood gathered Thursday night at the Soldotna Regional Sports Complex to discuss flooding in the area and possible solutions. The meeting was hosted by Dave Uregi, the Cape Beach resident facing legal action from the Kenai Peninsula Borough for an unpermitted canal he dug to move water in the neighborhood. The low-lying area has high groundwater and has been dealing with flooding issues for over a decade. Since spring break up this year, when a large volume of snowmelt overflowed the neighborhood, residents have been speaking out about damage to their properties and septic systems. The borough lowered the water level in parts of the neighborhood this summer and is hiring a consultant to study the effectiveness of its efforts. On Thursday, in front of about 40 attendees, Uregi talked about his decade-long history of experiencing flooding in the area and digging ditches. He distributed a list of 14 action items for property owners to take and showed off self-devised maps enumerating the extent of the flooding issue.
At the end of the day, what I want is the borough to step up, and if they're not going to do anything, then just get out of the way. Because there's plenty of people that have equipment and the ability to take care of the water problem in pretty short fashion.
Uregi told his neighbors the only solution to the problem is drainage. The borough disagrees with some of Uregi's solutions. It filed an injunction against him in July, telling him to stop action on his mile-and-a-half-long canal dug on borough property. In the court filing, the borough suggests that the ditch is making flooding worse for Uregi's neighbors and could release up to 2 million gallons of water onto other properties. On Thursday, over the more than three-hour meeting, Uregi critiqued the borough's response to the flooding, both the nature of its ditch work and the speed of its reaction. He made multiple calls for residents to take things into their own hands and encouraged them to appeal their property tax valuations in light of the flooding, equating the borough to his employee.
And because you're not doing your job and you're my employee, you work for me. If you're not doing your job, I ain't paying you. I'm not giving you money to not work. So bottom line is, appeal your taxes. Don't pay for an employee that doesn't do their job, period.
Borough Mayor Peter Michicki, who has been in office since February, arrived mid-meeting and gave the borough's perspective.
But I can tell you, the borough is done doing nothing. We're going to do what we can do to solve high groundwater and high surface water issues. Been here 6 months. You guys have been staring at this for a really long time.
Michicki emphasized that as a second-class borough, KPB has limited authority when it comes to flooding and only has powers related to the flow of water through roadside ditches. However, he said, the borough has drained tens of millions of gallons from parts of the neighborhood and allotted $175,000 last week to hire an independent hydrologist from Anchorage-based HDL Engineering Consultants to study the area. He emphasized residents need to work with the borough. As Michicki was leaving, meeting attendees made calls for the borough to declare an emergency and seek relief money. To be eligible for assistance, there must be an estimated $1.3 million in damages to public facilities like roads and bridges.
We're at the threshold.
There's a lot of people that are at the threshold right now. They're losing their homes. It may not be an emergency for you, but it's an emergency for them. And as a community, we can take action. And come hell or high water.
But Michicki explained the current situation has cost the borough less than half of that threshold amount.
It's an emergency for me. That doesn't mean I can skirt federal law declaring an emergency or state law. Still have to reach that threshold. We're trying to get there.
Okay.
On what we're spending, there are rules. You can't ignore them. I don't like the rules. I don't like bureaucracies. I don't like big government. But they're there. They're not going to give you the relief money if you don't meet the threshold.
Back in 2013, the Cay Beach area experienced a similar high water event. During that episode, the borough did declare an emergency and qualify for that relief, but Michicki says that was related to flooding across the entire peninsula, not just the Cay Beach area. Residents continued to share their issues with property flooding. Carl Strom and his wife created a Facebook page for residents to publicize their experiences.
Feel free to comment, share your testimonies, whatever you want on Facebook, because my wife and I, along with many other people, have had issues with their septics, with their water, with their flood issues, anything like that. So.
Jim Munter is an Anchorage hydrologist who has been working with Uregi for more than a decade and who owns property in the area. In the latter half of the meeting, he offered his own hydrological solutions and said he would work with residents to help them understand the flooding issue. Uregi continued to emphasize his lack of faith in the borough to solve the issue. But Michicki says he had positive conversations with attendees after the meeting about the borough's actions and says the borough's hydrological study will be expedited to address the ongoing issues. On Friday, the borough filed a request in order to push through their injunction related to the canal. Uregi, for his part, said he sees the lawsuit as an opening to bring the flooding issue to light. In Kenai, I'm Riley Board.
The Dillingham City School District wants to start growing its own greens. The district, which recently received $150,000 from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, plans to buy a hydroponic tank where students and staff can raise produce for school lunches. The money comes as part of the Department of Agriculture's effort to fund nutritious meals in rural schools. Paul Hewlett is the school district's business manager and food service director. He says the district plans to integrate the 40-foot tank into school curriculum.
It's going to incorporate into the elementary science curriculum, the middle high school science curriculum, as well as an economics class. They're going to do kind of a price point study and a marketing scheme and sell some of the excess that we get from the farm.
Produce is costly in Bristol Bay, even in the growing season. A head of lettuce, for example, currently costs about $7 at AC, one of two grocery stores in Dillingham. And in winter, unless it's frozen or grown in a private greenhouse, produce travels hundreds, if not thousands, of miles to get here, which can result in wilted, bruised veggies.
The problem, it always is transportation. You know, whenever it gets to the airport, then the cargo company, if the weather's bad out here, then it sits in the cargo. Sometimes it freezes, sometimes it sits for a couple days. So the product quality is usually a lot lower.
Hydroponic tanks can grow food year-round. In a tank, plants are placed above a tub of water with nutrients in it. The plant receives nutrients from the tub. Hydroponic tanks actually require less water and save space compared to traditional gardens. Hewlett says the district is planning to invest in a tank built for Arctic winters. According to Hewlett, the tank will cost the district about $2,000 in electricity each month, but he says that they've weighed this cost against the amount spent on produce and the health benefits to students and teaching opportunities that the tank would have to offer.
With the electrical cost and then also the component with the science curriculum and the teaching aspect, that's kind of how we've justified that electrical cost.
Hewlett says the school is considering applying for grant funding to buy solar panels that would help power the tank, reducing its electricity bill. Dillingham won't see school-grown produce right away. According to Hewlett, the district anticipates receiving the funds in October. They plan to get the tank set up next summer.
What will the Federal Reserve Chairman say far from Washington, D.C.? I'm Nova Safo with a Marketplace Minute. Central bankers and economists are gathering today in Jackson Hole, Wyoming for the central bank's annual conference, which begins in earnest tomorrow. We'll hear from Chair Jerome Powell amid growing expectations that the Fed will need to keep interest rates higher for longer to tame inflation. An economic indicator seen as a proxy for business investment rose 0.5% in July. That's the Commerce Department's core measure of durable goods orders, which factor out the volatile transportation sector. Initial claims for unemployment benefits declined slightly last week to a modest 230,000. The total number of people collecting aid remains around 1.7 million. I'm Nova Safo with a Marketplace Minute.
Marketplace Minute is supported by JLL, providing commercial real estate leasing and management. JLL.com.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Good afternoon and welcome to your Island Messenger for Thursday. It is the 24th day of August, the year 2023. The sun rose today at 6:53. It will set again at 9:29. That will give us 14 hours and 36 minutes of daylight, a loss of 4 minutes and 48 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record high temperature for this date was 72 degrees. That was set in 1938, and then again in 1957, and then again in 1987. Our record low is 38 degrees, set in chilly 1961. Currently 60 degrees. We earlier hit our predicted high temperature of 61, and now we're back down to 60. Humidity is at 86% at the airport right now. Southeast winds to 6 miles per hour, and they have 10 miles of visibility. Looking for a 40% chance of rain for the rest of the day, although there are increasing breaks in those clouds up here on Signal Hill. 20% chance of rain tonight, cloudy skies throughout the period, and south winds to 10 miles per hour. Look for an overnight low of 51 degrees. Rain is likely tomorrow afternoon, and then again all the way through tomorrow night, and rain is likely up until 1 p.m. or so on Saturday. Then it's going to go back to a 40% chance of rain for Sunday, and just a slight chance of rain for Monday. Looking at our local tides, we have a low tide coming up. That will happen at 1:06 p.m. here on the east side and be 3.2 feet, followed by a high tide at 7:46 p.m. of 8.1 feet. Over on the west side, your low tide will happen at 1:36 this afternoon and be 4.7 feet in Larsen Bay, followed by a high tide at 8:18 p.m. of 12.4 feet. Well, let's hear what the Alaska Department of Fish and Game has to tell us.
Hello, this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Kodiak with Kodiak Commercial Salmon Fishery Advisory Announcement number 37, date issued noon on August 23rd. There will be a 54-hour commercial salmon fishing period in the outer Katoy Bay section of the Afognak District from noon Thursday, August 24th to 6 p.m. Saturday, August 26th. As previously announced, the Duck Bay section of the Afognak District will now open to commercial salmon fishing for 78 hours from noon Wednesday, August 23rd until 6 p.m. Saturday, August 26th. There will be a 54-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Thursday, August 24th to 6 p.m. Saturday, August 26th in the following areas. In the inner Karluk section of the Southwest Kodiak District, the Iziut Bay, Northwest Afognak, and Raspberry Strait section of the Afognak District, the Mainland District, and the Cape Alatak, Alatak Bay, Mosier Bay, and Olga Bay sections of the Alatak District. The following areas will be extended from 6 p.m. Thursday, August 24th until further notice. The Northeast Kodiak District, the Eastside Kodiak District, the Humpy Deadman section of the Alatak District, and the Southwest Afognak and Northeast Afognak sections of the Afognak District. Closed waters are reduced from noon Thursday, August 24th to 6 p.m. Saturday, August 26th at Karluk Lagoon's exit channel terminus at the ocean shoreline, stream number 255101. The following areas are open to commercial salmon fishing until further notice. The outer Iakuluk, outer Karluk, Sturgeon, and Halibut Bay sections of the Southwest Kodiak District. The Northwest Kodiak District, except for the Uyak Bay and inner Uganic Bay sections, remain closed. And closed waters are expanded until further notice in that portion of the Southwest Afognak section of the Afognak District within 1/2 nautical mile of the beach near the stream terminus of Molina Creek, stream number 252105, between 58 degrees 10 north latitude and 58 degrees 11 north latitude. Cost recovery fisheries began in Katoy Bay Special Harvest Area on August 5th, and fishing opportunities in the Duck Bay, Iziut Bay, Inner Katoy Bay, and Outer Katoy Bay sections will depend on the ability of the Regional Aquaculture Association to meet cost recovery needs, and all cost recovery information may be obtained by calling 486-6559. Until further notice, within the Kodiak area, only that portion of the northwest and southwest Kodiak districts south of a latitude of Cape Kuliak, king salmon 28 inches or greater in length may not be retained by purse-seine gear in the commercial fishery and must be returned to the water unharmed. Other closed waters are shown in the Kodiak area salmon statistical chart, detailed in commercial salmon fishing regulations, and statistical charts, harvest strategies, and commercial salmon fishing regulations are available at the Kodiak Fish and Game Office, and of course, the most recent salmon fishery information may be obtained by calling the department's 24-hour record a phone at 486-4559. Thank you very much. Good luck fishing. And this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
Mariners, here is your marine forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanak out to 15 nautical miles. Small craft advisory through tonight on our east side with south winds to 25 knots today with 7-foot seas. South 25 tonight, seas to 6 feet. For tomorrow, south 20 and seas to 5 feet. However, on Friday night, they are calling for south winds to 30 knots, 8-foot seas, coming up to 10 feet on Saturday. Over in the Shelikof Strait, small craft advisory through tonight there as well. Variable winds to 15 will become south 25 this afternoon. 3-foot seas building to 6 feet this afternoon. For tonight, southwest 25 and 7-foot seas. And for tomorrow, south 20 with 5-foot seas. Friday night, look for southeast 25 and seas coming back up to 6 feet. For inside water mariners, here is your forecast for Chiniak Bay, south 20 today, 3-foot seas. Same forecast for tonight. For tomorrow, south 15 and seas to 2 feet. And for Friday night, south 25 and 3-foot seas, coming up to 4 feet on Saturday. Tomorrow is diaper distribution day at the Frontier Baptist Church Parsonage. That is at 1910 East Razanoff Drive, and it's going on between 4 to 7 p.m. Again, that's 4 to 7 p.m. tomorrow, diaper distribution day. First come, first serve. The senior citizens of Kodiak's Board of Directors will be meeting on Wednesday, August 30th at 1 p.m. in their multipurpose room. The Finance Committee will also meet that morning at 11 in the multipurpose room to review the FY24 budget. At the 1 p.m. board meeting, Hella Spellman, the accreditation on-site reviewer, will be meeting with the board and asking questions about the self-assessment process.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the midday report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.